Les uns vont se passer dans le moelle.
There's a car blocking the driveway for it.
Yeah?
Okay.
You have
cars. Yeah, no. Okay, Ian was Ian asked a question. This since we're gonna hand out for something. And this has to do with the folly of modern orthodoxy.
Is there an R-rated movie?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, not even R-rated. I told you about this?
Yeah, on Monday.
So did I tell you that they're negging on the deal?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the review. I brought it with me.
Woo!
So you guys can look at
this
it.
This is very cool.
So in the meantime, most of the rabbin have been sharing this with their shurim because they're annoyed about this too.
Okay.
Pass them down. They're 3 pages each.
Right.
Anyway, yes, well, I'm passing out Ian.
Yes.
Yes,
because today we were having a discussion in the chair here that
Rabbi Rakowski.
Well, it doesn't matter who it is involved.
Oh.
So there's a question asked in terms of the historical truth of certain events where we have a machlokes. So how do we reconcile this idea of prejudice, where Yisro was in the back before Matan Torah or after Matan Torah. So there's a machlokes, and how do we understand this with the saying in the Hebrew of things on it?
I'll tell you. Only one of them is correct historically, but one of them, but they both have. How should I put it? There is a philosophical or some other kind of idea, Kabbalistic idea, some other type of idea, which underlies. Anybody want? Oh, sorry, one more. Which underlies both opinions. In other words, you can derive a certain principle of Judaism from each opinion as to whether Yisro was Magaya before or after Matan Torah. Because it's not just a question of fact, you know, how are we supposed to know, but it's a question of what makes sense based on each Tana or Amora's perspective on what would be logical from his perspective of how the world works.
You can't say both are historically true.
No, with rare exception. They're like, there's the famous case in Gittin where they asked what happened with Pilegish Begiva, how the case, you know, she told you, I'm sure, that case, right?
Right.
So it happens sometimes, but it's not necessarily.
No, I looked up the case. We didn't go over that case. No, I looked it up in that book where you have all the different truths, and then you can look up where they are in Shas, and they didn't involve on and off.
Yeah.
So I don't think we read the case, actually.
Well, it's the guy's case in Shoftim, the passage is not usually studied in Yeshiva because A, we don't study Nachbi, we don't study the controversial part. So this is where this guy had a concubine, and his concubine he got upset at his concubine, and he kicked her out of the house one night, and she got raped and killed, and all sorts of nasty things happened afterwards. So the question is why he got mad at her, and one version is that he found a fly in his soup, and the other is that he found that she was not fully, she hadn't shaved her body hair properly. So the Gemara says, how can they both be true? So the Arnavi says that they're both true. He found one of them, but he did get angry, and he got angry after the second one. So that's the case in which historically both could have happened. But even there, the catalyst was one of the two. Just that both occurred, perhaps one of them contributed to be the catalyst why he got upset at her. I once had a radical theory, which I no longer hold to be true, I never held to be true, I just hypothesized it, which is that Chazal can come actually post facto and change history retroactively.
Whoa.
Meaning that since all things transcend time, and on some ultimate level, in other words, all past, present, and future, from the divine perspective of Hashem, are all one entity, indivisible. So therefore, just as the past affects the future affects the past. Now, this Rav Tzadok says this. You say about Rosh Chodesh. He says that Rosh Chodesh is a holiday which celebrates the future, an event which hasn't occurred yet, and even events in the future have an impact already now, although not as strong an impact. But this would be taking it even a step further and saying that what Chazal would say in the Shas about a historical episode would retroactively determine how that episode took place.
Hmm. How did you even come up with that idea? What led you on that? I'm not thinking. I mean, is there something you saw in some writings that triggers?
No. That's why I've discarded it, because I never found any evidence for it.
So why can't you explain?
I can, but that would be silly. Wait a minute, let me put that in perspective.
Because it would be silly? I just
said it, right? So you heard me say it.
Right.
But I'm saying I cannot...
But you don't believe it.
I cannot responsibly say that that's the case. I've never seen anybody say it. But it doesn't mean I don't retain it in the back of my head, maybe someday hoping to prove it. But it's right now, it's not my operating assumption.
You're saying the future doesn't determine the past? It can't affect the past?
Sorry?
You're saying that the future can't affect the past? Is that what you're saying?
It can, but here's taking a step further. This is shaping the past.
It would be
the equivalent of saying that, Napoleon did conquer Russia. If Chazal said Napoleon did conquer Russia, so retroactively, Napoleon would have conquered Russia. That's a pretty radical thing to say, don't you think?
That's cool.
I mean, I don't mind saying radical things, but
that's just wrong.
Okay. Thank you for that vote of confidence.
So,
by saying that, make that man think.
Yes.
These people in the future.
Until he said it was wrong, it was right. And now he changed history.
Now,
right.
Here's the thing, though. He changed it back. So, if it was true that you could you can't retroactively change the past, all you have to really do is rewrite the history book.
It's not really changing it, right? That's not really the case. And the marshal I gave was a very poor marshal, actually. It means that since everything happens simultaneously and just gets unpacked over time, so therefore, yes, because I would have determined now that Napoleon did not conquer Russia. If I came along and said 100 years later that was the case, and I was Chazal, so that would have been determinative that he wasn't going to conquer Russia in the past. Not that they changed history, but they shaped history. You're correct about that. Okay? Did anybody read this while you had it? What?
Always, within the school, you can also have it. As a school.
What's the scope?
Is that where the reader
at? The scope is the MTA student newspaper.
Okay.
How long ago was this written?
Last week.
Oh, what's MTA?
It's not no longer the name of the school, but it remains the initials of the school. It stands for Manhattan Talmudical Academy. The school is no longer called that. It's called the Marsha Stern Talmudical Academy, but nobody likes saying that, so they just call it MTA. MTA stuck. Always MTA.
Yeah.
So this actually is happened last week.
And what is this whole thing about?
What's wrong with R-rated movies?
Well, depends why they're R-rated.
No.
They're pure gas.
Anything they can make a film R-rated and make it for him.
What?
What things make it for R-rated?
They would make it R-rated.
Violence, sex. Language, what else makes it more rude?
That's it. What's wrong with violence in a film?
Why don't you read the paper?
I
know you can. Read it. Mother of Aim, one of the lower shiur in lower 11th grades, that said he did this with his shiur this morning. He said he had to translate it into their English. So, but once it was translated, they did understand what it was about. Or what they did accept the idea.
They accepted it, or they understood it?
Well, it's not that they're necessarily going to stop watching, but they understood what the downsides are. That's also something. Let's get these done.
So they just stopped publishing our reviews?
No! They refused, they didn't keep the end of the deal. They said they were going to, if I were their deal, they made the deal that if I wrote this piece, they would stop. No, these are not, these were different. If I wrote this piece, they would stop reviewing R-rated movies for the rest of the year. But they reneged on that. They refused to fulfill their part of the bargain.
What does it mean, review R-rated movies?
So I'm not publishing this. In every issue of this newspaper, they have a review of one R-rated movie. School tradition.
What movies, for example?
I don't know, it's hard for me. I don't remember. I didn't even look at what the movie was, name was. I just heard rated R. Okay, I obviously did not do this right. Oh no, no, it's fine. Actually, never mind. Scratch that. Okay, so two pages. Okay, the Ayin Dalet and 146. I'm going to pass half out this way and half out that way. Okay, 146 is first, actually.
Yeah, I have a question, though. How do we then draw the line in terms of living in a closed, protected community and when we should exit those communities or not? I mean, it seems almost that we should never leave a community, first a new square. We should just always stay within the new square if that is possible. Make our community as similar to new square as possible. Because if we go outside, we may see somebody that's dressed inappropriately, or maybe something.
You really didn't read this. I don't know. You guys don't read.
I read half of it.
Read. You might as well be students of mine in high school. My God.
I read half of it. I read half of it. You're going to start, so I'm not going
to
get it before you start. That's the problem.
What?
Is there anybody else now?
I would say.
I read
my
twice. You said that a lot of this reshapes the way you think about things.
Yeah.
No. That's the entire reason, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, look at that chair with
me. Makes you a bad person.
It does. Why are you kidding? It does make you a bad person.
Why?
Watch
it.
Watch
it.
I'm not a
bad person.
It's good for you.
It doesn't make you a bad person completely, but it's bad. It's a bad, becomes a bad component of your inner soul.
It hinders the neshama.
What?
It hinders the neshama.
It certainly makes an imprint on the neshama.
Someone should come out
and
say you can't watch them.
The
movies are more
cherished
than the
McDonald's.
You freeze whose account? The student?
Yeah.
I can't really do that. I mean,
you shouldn't teach that.
It's much more fun.
We're getting paid.
No, they're going through all these. They need people to teach them because they're
true. Well, at least you're providing.
They're tinoko shenishbu. They really don't know anything.
That's true.
Okay. I got into a big fight with him today, actually, and I'm not sure how to deal with this. You know, I do this Jewish talk through movies thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jewish what?
I didn't tell you guys about this?
Yeah.
You did.
Yeah.
So we just finished Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and I did, but now we start a new one. Chariots of Fire.
Nice.
Who's seen Chariots of Fire?
Is that the running movie?
Yeah.
With the T-Cross
on the
what's the running thing?
The three guys. What the actor's name is, I have no idea. So, Lamaisa, I stopped the movie in the middle and I said, you know, this whole thing of competitive sports being a form of Avodas Hashem, which is actually what the movie implies, according to one of the runner's versions, I think it's ridiculous.
But then your colleague said so.
And, yes, I know. And they said, but I said, not just because of sports, but because of competition. And they jumped all over me and they said, the whole world is competition. In other words, it's not just sports. Competitive sports is just like anything else. You compete for a job, you compete for a school, you compete for a job. Everything in the entire world is competition. And that's the way it's built, and that's how you achieve excellence.
You're not a capitalist.
That's not how the Torah
That's not very Jewish.
That's not the Torah.
Yeah, I don't think that's very Jewish.
Yeah.
It's not very communist.
No, because the competition's like push the other person out of the way, get where you need to get.
Capitalism is not, neither is communism, but the capitalism is certainly not the preferred method because it implies, yes, trammeled competition. Although it's ironic, the Chazon Ish says, if you're really a Baal Bitachon, if you're real Baal Bitachon, then he wouldn't mind, because Hashem's going to give you what you need anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That's, but if you, most people are not holding at that level,
so you
wouldn't,
yeah, you wouldn't have to gauge in something.
Well,
yeah,
the person can't even move something in Herod's breast. Hashem's thing, it says that the positions in the base make this, you know, someone wanted to be crushed in the sense or whatever, bake the bread, and they couldn't have that position because it wasn't retrieved from mine.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean you won't compete for it. In other words, if there's a job opening in a law firm, right?
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying the students, why is it, what's the purpose of competition if it's decreed?
Because you don't know.
You have to make a stablish. You have to make an effort. It doesn't go without an effort.
Right, but...
What was the economic system of the first base of English, second base of English? There were safeguards against competition.
Weren't allowed to open a similar shop within the same alley or, you know, the same street, whatever.
It's just a highly regulated type of capital.
Yes. Yeah.
What?
Also, not allowed to persuade people to come and buy, not allowed to give kids candies in order to get them to come into your store, things like that.
No problem.
So you think there's a problem with offering bucks for $100 to come to davening every day?
Why?
Five bucks.
If you go to 50,
45 out of 50 did.
90% of the time, I'll give you $100
certificate. Five bucks.
Easy.
Very nice.
10 minutes.
Like, come on, you're the daughter. I mean, of course you start out with incentives.
Okay. Someone without the incentive, go for the incentive.
So my dad said,
No, that was good, you know.
Okay, I tell you. Okay, so let's get back to our regularly scheduled program.
Is Yassan?
What?
Is Yassan, no?
Not yet. Now, I'm going to read you one line outside, which from the previous page, which you don't have, okay? The beginning, there's one line in the previous page, which goes, Amar Rabba Barachana said, Zimna Chad at one time, Hava Kozlinam B'Madbara. We switched gears very lastly. Now we're in the desert. Vitzlavi Badon, I'm out of the page yet. Vitzlavi Badon, they accompanied us, now on the top of 146. Hahu Taya, a certain Arab merchant. Now, to have a shakil afra, he would take dirt, umorachle, and he would smell the dirt. V'aman, he said, ha urcha l'duchta palon, this way is the way to this certain place. V'aman, this way is the duchta palon, is the way to that certain place. Aminale, we said to him, kama rachkin, amimai, how distant are we from water? V'aman, he said to us, havuli afra, give me some dirt. Yavinolay, we gave it to him. For Amalan, he said, Tamnaya Parse, 8 parcels, which is approximately, 8 parcels is 24 kilometers.
Hmm.
Okay? Tanina of Yavinolay, we gave it to him again later on. For Amalan, he said, the Marakina Tlusa Parse, there were 3 parcels different. Obviously, we switched the piles of dirt. We couldn't overcome him. So the Hakosev on the bottom, which we said is the Ritva, it says Uvda Detaya. This case with the Arab merchant, the Morach Ara, who smelled the land, Dover Tivihu. It's a natural thing. I believe the Indians were able to do things like this. The American Indians, they're able to appreciate from dirt where the soil was
fertile
or not fertile, how far the water was. I don't know if they knew exactly which way to go on, but there are things which people can derive even without Ruach HaKodesh, just by taking and having an expertise in understanding how dirt is impacted upon by its surroundings. You know, even this thing about which way to go to which city, that also could be because there's a certain kind of mud which comes from that city, which has a certain type of smell, which he smelled in this dirt, and knew that people walking around on the path were going to and from that city. But he says, even though there's a simple pshat here, he says there's a deeper pshat also. He says, nevertheless, yeshbo moshel, there is an analogy here. He has some orchosav, somebody who evaluates his pathways, zoche makabo pnei shechina, he merits receiving the countenance of the shechina. In other words, dirt really means symbolic to our travels in this world. Generally speaking, whenever we talk about a midbar, we talk about our travels through this world. You know, for example, at the end of Parshas, the end of Sefer Vayikra, in Parshas B'chukosai, you have a list of the 42 trips which the Jews took through the desert, 42 stations. And the Baalei Machshava, the thinkers say that these correspond to the 42-letter name of God. You know the 42-letter name of God?
Oh, yes, you do.
Where is it in the Siddur?
On the Bekoa.
On the Bekoa. Very good.
What?
You know,
it is in the German Siddur. In Carbono.
I know what it is. I've seen it. I know what it is.
Anyway, Ana Bekoach is a Kabbalistic compilation of the 42 letters, you know, as Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of words. So these 42 trips are the way in which you traverse the world with this name of 42 letters, which also is the name by which a person traverses this world. Obviously, we don't know how to use the name in practical in a practical manner, but that sort of represents the 42 trips, the 42 letters, and this was 42 trips through the desert. And one goes through the desert when one goes through life. So therefore, this is something where you wherever you go, you have to smell what's going on in order to make sure that you know which way you're going and how we have to go. Now, of course, the metaphor is very, very, very obvious. Smelling is spiritual, right? Because it's in the spirit, it's in the wind, right? So when you're smelling the dirt, you're smelling, and dirt is really the opposite of spirituality. So you're smelling how much spirituality there is in the dirt, which is your existence. And, of course, how far you are from water, that's easy too. What does that represent? Torah, right? Some people get further away from Torah, some people are closer to Torah. You can tell who's further and who's closer from Torah if you try and figure out which person has the superior refinement of character and intelligence. So then you know that person is closer to Torah. So this Arab shepherd actually represents, it's a fascinating thing. The Arab shepherd in this story, this Arab guide, I guess, would be a more proper description. He represents your guide through life. This guide through the desert is your guide through life, and he is telling you, smell everything, make sure it's the right spirituality, figure out how far you are from water, and never get confused. That would be the martial part. Okay? So again, according to Ritva, it could be understood on two levels. The level that it's actually a Pashas thing, that's a real thing, but there's also a level which most of the Pashas take here, of course, that it is metaphorical. But we're not finished with this guy yet. Okay? So the Gemara goes on and says, Amar Li, he said to me, Tava Ach Melech Mese Midbar. It's one of the very weirdest stories in Shas. Let's come and I'll show you the people who died in the desert. Now, people who died in the desert, they were not such good people, it would seem, right? They were the ones who were died in those 40 years because they sinned with the sin of the spies, right? So, they shouldn't be. They should be. There's one sheet that they don't have a chayuk olam haba, right? It's not to be taken literally.
Who is the judge?
What?
Who is the judge? Really?
No. The way it works is like this, if you're a Kabbalist, is that each neshama can be subdivided many times, right? So therefore, that part of their neshama, which lives in that body, in that time, that doesn't go and have olam haba. But the rest of the neshama will. Everybody gets fixed up in the end. Okay? So he said, let me show you these guys, the dead people. So Azli, so we went, the Chazisinu, and we saw them, the Ramu, and they were lying down, command the Bismar, the Bimisame, like somebody who was happy, literally inebriated. In other words, they were lying there in a state of tranquil repose. Okay, they're resting easy. So, in the Gani Aparki, and they were lying on their backs. We bury people on their backs. Vavaz Kifa Birche de Chaminayu. And the knee of one of them was up like this. Right? It was his knee was up in the air. V'al taya tusei, and this Arab merchant went under the knee, went under the knee, kirachiv gamra, while he was riding a camel, uzkifa rumche, and his spear was extended high, v'lo nagabe, and he couldn't touch the knee.
That was how big this person was.
Yeah, it's like Gulliver's Travels. He was a giant, relatively speaking, right?
Wow.
So again, here, I think the metaphor is clear. When you see the Meitei Midbar, then you realize that they were of tremendous stature, even though the Chumash depicts them as big sinners. You know, there's a general principle, which is that of the author from Slabodka. Not everybody agrees with him. But the Avos Sabotka holds that anybody who's mentioned the Chumash, he was Chashuv, right? You might not think of him as Chashuv because the Chumash portrays him in a negative light, but in reality, he was very Chashuv.
Even like Esav or Yishmael?
Even Esav.
Or like Laban?
Yeah.
Why?
The joke was in Sabotka, they would say, Esav Arashah, Kadosh Hashem.
Paro?
Yeah. Also Paro. Yeah. They were all big people. They were all Rosh Yeshiva. You know, it says when Hashem, when Avraham Avinu invited, made a party for Yitzchak's birth, he invited the Gdoli Hador. You know, who are the Gdolim? Avimelech, Paro,
Nimrod.
I don't know if Nimrod made the cut.
He's saying,
yes, he made the Chumash, so I guess he does. So the point is that the way, and this really originates with Arizal. You know, the Arizal said that Esav, his mouth was holy. His mouth was holy, and therefore his head was pretty holy, and that's why his head was buried in the Maharas HaMachpelah. And I once spoke to one of the great Slabodka Rosh Yeshiva in that tradition, Reb Simcha Zusser Broida, and he said that I asked him this is a question, and he confirmed this. Okay, the way they would understand Esav is that Esav would come into a base manager and have a long white beard, and a long coat with two buttons in the back, and a Hamburg hat, and you would put him on the mizrach. You would go put him up in one of the most significant places. But you couldn't tell on the outside that he was different. You have to look deep, deep inside to see that corruption, which was Esav. So it's an interesting approach towards Chumash. It means it makes everything much more nuanced and subtle than it actually seems on the surface. Hmm. So also it's the Meitei Midbar. What he's saying is that, you know, you think that these guys were jerks and we're much better than they are. No. You should know, if you try to attain their level, not only that, if you try to attain their level by learning everything there is to know till now, in other words, like riding on a camel, and not only that, you stick up your spear way above your head, you go beyond your normal capacity to understand, and you go way into it, you won't even reach their knees. In other words, you still will not get at their essence. You'll still be stuck down here, right, at the second joint, so to speak. You won't get anywhere, because their madrega, that they saw Matan Torah. Their madrega was so incredibly high that there was no comparison and no way that anybody can ever understand them. Okay, that's what really what I think this is about. And I don't know exactly why this is, but berech, which is the Hebrew word for knee, is obviously related to bracha, which is also base resh chav, and related to bechor, which is base chav resh, which is the firstborn. So I guess the knee is what you extend out from your body first when you're walking. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right? So in essence, it is we can't even reach that thing which is the first manifestation, the first thing which comes into view, so to speak, and it does not really, but the first thing which comes close to you and the thing which you have most possibility of seeing is the knee. We don't come up even to their knees. Okay, so what happened? And now it's a very strange thing which happened. Now I just gave a beautiful metaphorical explanation, or maybe not even so beautiful, but metaphorical. And now the Gemara comes along and says, Amali, No, sorry. Paski chadakana d'tchelta d'chad minayu. I cut one of the corners of the tchelis of one of their garments. Because I wanted to show, wanted to bring it back, and show how they tied the tzitzis in the midbar. So, below have a mask and mitzagim on. We couldn't walk. It was so either so massive, or probably more likely, it was so
unwieldy,
but so much beyond his capacity to grasp that he couldn't cart it away. In other words, in order to cart this thing away, you have to have a proper level of kedusha. You can't, if you don't have that proper level of kedusha, you can't do it. So that remains in place. He can't walk. By the way, this is the source for tearing the tzitzis of a person who dies. Because, you know, whenever they bury a person, a man, they bury him in a shroud and in his palace. But before they take him out, they possible the palace. So there's a famous maestro with the Groh. The Groh was, you know, Groh commanded, he left the will that after his death, they should not possible the palace. There's no reason for it. Just because here, Rav Rakhana took off the corner of the palace from the dead person, doesn't mean it's something you have to do. So as he was going outside of the door of the Beit Midrash, as the coffin was leaving, or as the body wrapped in the palace, one of the strings, I know this happens to us a lot too, one of the strings caught on the door, snagged, and became also. So the siman min hashamayim, don't tamper with minhagim. You know what else that happened to the girl? There was a time when he wanted to institute in his shul in Vilna. He had his own shul, funded by the community. So he wanted to in his shul brichas kohanim every day in chutzlars, like the Sfaradim do, right? So that day in which he wanted to institute it, there was a fire in his Beis Medrash.
Mm-hmm.
So he took it as a sign not to tamper with minhagim. At least that was this minute. There's also a similar story about the Marashal. The Marashal of Shlomo Luria, it was somewhat earlier, he wanted to institute the saying of Shasimcha b'ma'ono, invention by a seum. Right? Shasimcha b'ma'ono is one of the additional things we say by the benching at a chasna, by the Sherev Brachos, Brucha Elkeinu, Shasimcha b'ma'ono, Shachang Mishloos v'Ocheinu. So that he took out that he wanted to put in Shasimcha b'mono into the seum zimun. So that day he wanted it was a seum or bar mitzvah. I think it was a seum, but maybe it was bar mitzvah. Anyway, be as it may, whatever happened, the fire broke out. So he didn't get a chance to do it, and he took that as a sign from heaven that it was not proper to use that version when a seum or a bar mitzvah. So in any event, so he said in the third line, Omar Lee, the Arab merchant said to him, Dilma shakal tamida minay, maybe you took something away from them. Give it back. Digmire, because we have learned, or we know that we have a tradition, demand the shakal midi minay lomistadile. Anybody takes something from them, cannot walk. He's stuck in place. So the idea here, again, I don't think it's because of the weight. I think it's because of some spiritual thing. Is that if you try to accomplish something which is not on your level, then you won't be successful. For example, they say, I don't know if this would apply today anyway, but they say about the Chofetz Chaim, one of the more famous stories about the Chofetz Chaim, which leads me to doubt its truth. But one of the more famous stories is that every time he sent a letter by a courier, he would rip up a postage stamp so as not to cause the government a loss. You got that? If he wouldn't say, oh, I saved the postage by sending it with this other guy. He would rip up the postage, the price of postage.
Why did he
didn't want him to cause a loss to the post office. Just because he's sending the letter privately, why should the post office lose out on its fee, which it could have made?
I'm glad I'm not doing that with email.
Yeah, well, the point is like this. The point is, if any one of us did that to a stamp when we sent a letter by, you know, or a note or whatever it was with somebody else, a third party, then we would be the biggest Bali guy in the world.
I don't understand even why you did that.
Right, and we can't even really understand it. It's so high, way above our level.
Why did he do it with anything like oranges? Instead of, you know, he didn't compensate someone for an orange. He had went to a different store to buy an orange.
He didn't go to a regular store
and say, "Oh, I could have bought an orange from you. You were close to my house." I mean, what's the difference?
What? That makes sense. Because if they're accustomed, if he's used, normally accustomed to sending things with the thing, so by him diminishing it, it does affect things.
He held that this is, since the post office has actual control over the mail, and he would have sent it by mail, so therefore the post office deserves to get its share, which you should have given them in any event.
He probably made him more
secure that his letter would get to its destination or something like that.
There's a different story I heard of a couple of times that my Rebbe told me last year that he heard from one of his family members that that wasn't true. So the story that they tell like the whole time is like this guy stole his stuff from his house and he's like, the guy ran away and said, "Oh, you can have it. Suppose his family members say it didn't happen like that at all. So like he actually said, "No, like you're gone, like come back with my stuff."
Makes sense. But even if not, Lamai said, we can't even understand ripping up a postage stamp, right? That's what it has to do with our capitalist perspective, which is, hey, if you can save a buck, more power to you, right? So that's our intrinsic capitalist perspective on things, which is not, as we mentioned before, not necessarily a good thing.
Right.
But besides that, we're so mocked on everybody's 40 cents that we're going to start ripping up postage stamps for the government. So therefore, it's well beyond our level of capacity. So if you try to jump up that high, then all you're doing is being a ball guy, though. You're not achieving anything significant. Okay, so that's where the idea of taking away the garment, part of the garment, means you're holding by that madriga of a corner of their garment that you have an affinity to. Says the Arab shepherd, no, we understand if you take any part of them, that you're not going to be able to go anywhere. Okay.
How do you ever increase your level then? How do you ever increase your Madriga?
Well, you don't jump back from the times of the Moroim to the times of Chumash. There's a story that when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai died, Gemara Bracha says, so he said, prepare a chair for, anybody remember? Prepare a chair for for Chizkiah, the king of Yehuda. Right? Ezekiah. Why? Because Chizkiah was made all sorts of tikkunim in Jewish people, and so they're Yochanan ben Zakkai. There was a sefer called the Magen Shlomo. The Magen Shlomo, it was the grandfather of Pnei Yehoshua. Magen Shlomo means protector of Shlomo. He protected the Rashi from all Tosfos questions. So he went Tosfos by Tosfos and refuted the Tosfos question on Rashi. So when he died, he said, prepare a chair, because Rashi is coming to greet me, to take me to the world to come. So, you know, obvious question would be, I don't know, such an obvious question, but one might ask, you know, why couldn't he get Chizkiyahu? Why did he got only Rashi. Why did he get Chizkiyahu? Because the way it works is each generation has its own level, and the thing which can relate to, which is above its level as well. And to jump back to Rabbi Yochanan to Chizkiyahu, it's not on the level of this person who died now. So therefore, it's not relevant to his experience. Yeah.
So how do you take things from Gemara and you're supposed to learn with Gemara and Talmud and like do it? So the brachas daf yomi like a review book where they had the different lessons from daf yomi and brachas, and like one thing said, well, when they were learning, they won't even say bless, like, you know, to bless you, that like they're because there's, you know, it's all towards, you know, so if you do that, it's like, no, like you just don't, you know, if you go and not say God bless you, are you being like, you know, rude, or is it no, like you're really learning what level you should be on?
I don't think it's rude. I don't think it's rude, because people know that, you know, the people don't like interrupting and learning.
Yeah.
Quite, I thought you were going to go in a different direction. I thought you were going to ask if one's allowed to interrupt and learning.
Okay, that'd be another one. Yeah, sure. That's
the,
yeah, that's it too.
What?
Are you allowed to interrupt everybody?
So the thing is like this: you have by interrupting learning, we have a principle. Gadol Talmud Shemedu Zei Maisa. Why is learning great? Because it brings people to do stuff. So therefore, when a mitzvah overis comes in front of you, when you're learning, mitzvah's time will pass. You can't push it off. You're supposed to do it right away.
Yeah.
Right?
Does that go along with what you're supposed to want to them? And like, how can you be so holy? And then you like, if I say hello to you, like, you know, if you were to say hello to someone while learning, like, is it that type of thing, you know?
Well, it's a similar thing. In other words, you have to do the right thing. Even though you may have learned, there's a principle of doing the right thing. Right? You have to go and do that which is accepted, will decide and make you accepted, as so to speak, as well. And what was your case again? I forgot your case.
My case is either, you know, you stay in learning and someone.
Oh yeah, bless you. Okay. So the so what I was going to say, and there's something I wanted to say about that, which is yeah, Rav Shlom Shapol Hirsch. Rav Shlom Shapol Hirsch says it's the famous verse from Rav Shlom Shapol Hirsch. It's famous, so famous that some because it's one of the few that I know. So Rav Shlom Shapol Hirsch says in his commentary of us, you know, the Mishnah, which says a very strange Mishnah, says Mahalach Baderech, somebody who's walking down the road and thinking, talking to Beit Torah. And he's mopsic and says, he stops and says, how beautiful is this tree?
Mm.
So, Mishchai is Chai Misa. Not Mason, but, you know, Misa B'dei Shemayim. So, like a capital spiritual crime. So, Rav Shlom Shapol Hirsch has this famous piece on this. He says, you know, it's Chai Misa, the guy for whom it's an interruption in his learning to say that this tree is a beautiful tree. You got that?
No.
That should be an integral part of your learning. It says that who's the guy who should be put to death? Hamasik mishmaso. So I mean, interrupts his learning by saying mano ironzeh, because his viewing nature is separate from his learning Torah. It's not one seamless whole. But when he sees the tree, you should be part and parcel of your learning. I was learning, and this part of my learning, how wondrous Hashem is.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have that perspective, then you're in the crowd now. So that's like the famous story when Shlom Shapol Hirsch went to the Alps, one of the, you know, for rest of recreation. And they asked him why he did it, and he said, well, he's afraid after 120 years, because of the Shemayim, the Kodesh Baruch was going to ask him, no, Shimshin, did you see my Alps? Or did you go have that amazing experience of seeing these wondrous mountains? So, the same thing would bless you on a different level, right?
I guess
that's the Lithuanian version of the story. The Yekisha version of the story is that he went to the Alps. And he explained he went to the Alps because, you know, he didn't want, when he comes up to Shemayim, that Hashem's going to say to him, Shimon, did you see my Alps? Shamshon, Shimon would see my Alps, and he would have to say no.
I'm not going to ask that. Yeah, that's one of the questions
they ask. He's been there,
you
know.
You see?
I've heard.
The,
Yeah, but
it says the four questions which they ask every person.
Yeah.
They can't ask every person whether he saw the Alps.
Why not?
What do you mean? Not everybody can get there.
I saw you see the Grand Canyon?
I got to see the Alps.
No, but
I thought about that when I was passing out. I think about that person.
You know the story.
Yeah. So what are the four questions?
Was you honest in business? Did you look forward to the redemption? Did you try to have children? And did you set aside time to learn Torah? Yeah.
There you go.
Okay.
There's a story in Visions of Greatness, Volume 4, that this guy had a near-death experience and he had like a whole thing about that.
Yeah.
Supposedly, like, he died for like a little bit, and like he he said that the whole thing happened like that. I don't know. He didn't know.
Very cool. I don't need to ask everybody the Alps question, but Josh,
so
you might be asked. Whether you saw the Liberty Bell.
So what do you mean by that?
So
what do you mean by that?
Yeah. Did you see Rocky's picture?
Yeah. No.
I don't think they're gonna ask that one.
So what do you mean by it then? Like,
what?
What do you mean by that?
No. So this is the thing. Also, if you're saying "bless you," right?
Yeah.
Is an interruption in your learning?
Yeah.
They don't do it.
Okay.
But if it's part and parcel of your learning,
right.
In other words, you feel that this is the way you express yourself
right.
In a proper and civilized manner to another person,
right.
Then you do too. So you would.
Right. So the Islamic thing was when the guy didn't say Shalom Aleichem to him, there's a separate mitzvah besides the one that they always bring down for Yom Kippur or Shalom Aleichem. But there's a different mitzvah. I think he was either, I thought the guy was either dominant or learning, and he was walking on the street, and he was like in his head, he was trying to learn something, and Rabbi Solon just said, you know, Shalom Aleichem, the guy didn't say anything back.
I thought he was working. Was he working?
I mean, I don't know. I thought one was like, you're so holy, like, why can't you say hello? It's like typical Rabbi.
Yeah, that's the famous line of Rabbi Solon, that you steal, if you don't say hello to somebody, then you're stealing from them.
Right.
Because you're stealing their right, so to speak, for you to be pleasant to them.
Right.
From the white suit, Jesus.
Right.
Absolutely.
But a lot of people don't hold by that.
Right. But what about when you're working?
What?
When you're working, when a person's working, when someone interrupts, you don't necessarily, kind of like stealing from that
point. If you're hired by the hour you work, then that would be true. But if you're hired by the project, which I think most people are, so I'm not so sure how true that is. Okay. So he took this thing and couldn't go, and they said, as they had dreamed to, they went back and put it back. Then we were able to walk. When I came from the rabbis, Amuli, they said to me, to Rabbi Barchana, call Abba Chama, any Abba, which is, his name was Rabba, which is a contraction of Rab Abba. So every Rab Abba is a donkey. Okay, which means they're calling him a donkey. The call Bar Bar Chana, and anybody who's the son of Chana, which was his name also, Sich Sicha. He just causes strife. What?
I like that word, Sich
Sicha. Sich Sicha, he causes strife. So they're upset. They're upset because he didn't go there. He's going to explain. So he says, Lamayach, so why'd you cut off the corner? Lamayach saw Bidisacha, did you do this? Lamayach, to know Ike Beishamai, Ike Beisil, to know if the halacha is like Beishamai or the halacha is like Beisil, because they have different counts as to how many strings you put and how many knots you make. So he bought the Mine Chutin, Ike Beisil, I'm sorry, Ike Beishamai, if it's like Beishamai, he bought the Mine Chutin. You should have checked out how many strings there are. It could be silly, but you should have checked out how many gaps there were between. So these are issues which were under dispute and contention at the time. So therefore, that's what you should have done when you got to these Mesei Midbar in order to determine who's right in these various different sheets of statistics. Just memorize it. Now, this is very hard to allegorize. Right? Because it sounds like they really wanted to know halacha, and the rabbi, they upset Rabbi Chana for not bringing them back halachic proof. So it's hard for me to get out of this one, but I can. The Rabbi Chana, he didn't, I had it a minute ago, now I lost it. One second. Yeah, Rabbi Chana tried to jump a madrega up, right? And that's why he couldn't go, because he couldn't take it with him. But he could have taken the inspiration with him. In other words, tzitzit is supposed to remind you, even if you don't physically grab them, right? They're supposed to remind you. They're supposed to remind you of Hashem. So therefore, what they're saying is, you should have been inspired to be able to go up madrigas, and you shouldn't have felt that you have to bring it back. Now, if you're feeling you have to bring it back, you were just an imbecile. Okay, so you could have gone and said how many there were, and figuratively, which could be little, it's difficult to comprehend, but could be little, but figuratively speaking, it means, so what? So you can't take the thing, but you can take the inspiration from it. you can look at, you could look at them, size them up, and then take the inspiration from them. But you chose not to do, you didn't think of doing that. The if you take a look at Ritva over here, he takes this whole thing pretty simple. Nahakosev, he says the Balamar comes to say kilokasoi enom, their eyes did not become diminished in their sight. They look as if they were red from wine. And even though they were on the mountain, they were passing through the valley, and the height was this height of a camel driver riding with the spear upright. He wasn't able to perceive their needs. Nevertheless, they look very, very red. The redness which he's referring to is before we said they look like they were inebriated, right? Basume. So he says that they look very red. And next line, I don't really understand. It says, in other words, what he's saying is that they could see that red face from a distance, even though they were way, way far away. And this is a description of how far away they were from the Beis HaMikdash. They could see that their countenance was happy and red from that distance. And they certainly would have sensed it if they were up close. So in essence, what the Ritva is saying is that the appreciation for the high level of the Dor HaMidbar, which is indicated by seeing them in this pleasant repose, that was already something which they could perceive even at a very far distance away. Even when they were literally at the knees down below, they could perceive that this mace had a special unique quality to him. So I think that also goes back to this idea from before, that the generation in the desert was on a much higher level, and therefore we really can't comprehend it, but from a distance we can see that. From a distance, we could see that even the Meisei Midbar were very, very, very high level in their kedusha, and their ruchnius, and their connection to Hashem. Even though the chumash it sounds like they were just brats, that's not the case. The next week, we're going to see also. I think it's next week. We're going to see the contradistinction between these guys, who are just a generic Meisei Midbar, and the Korach people.
Mm.
Okay? You know the story about the Korach people? They're still roasting.
Oh.
At least the time of the Gemara, they're still roasting.
No.
Yeah. Oh. So, we'll have to see that. So they are not in pleasant repose. Because they were the ones who were sinners. Why? Because they wanted to undermine Moshe Rabbeinu's authority. So they really... therefore, they were the ones who really suffered. Anything else, if you have a desire, some sort of lust, you know, for a fruit or for a piece of meat or whatever it is, you want the fish and the squash which you had in Mitzrayim, that's bad, but not so bad. Even the Egel Azor, Avodah Zarah is a really cool thing, right? People like Avodah Zarah, right? But Korach, he was really just trying to get Moshe Rabbeinu for the sake of his own power and his own agenda. That was the worst possible thing in the middle.
He had lust for power.
In fact?
He had lust for power.
Yes.
So, it's worse than lust for meat.
What?
That's
it is worse,
than
yeah.
Lust for meat?
Yeah. Because he knew Moshe Rabbeinu was the great leader chosen by Hashem. And he had such gaiva that he thought, but nevertheless, Hashem made a mistake. Or, it should have happened differently. That's a much more powerful sin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, everybody's like, pick up with this next week.
Thank you.
Anybody want to
involve the I don't want to die. No, it's not. He was doing it.